amazingly, the Doors' debut album is now 50 years old. 50 years since that landmark debut. Backdoor Man is one of the great songs from that album. We're talking now about one of the iconic images known all over the world, the Great Pyramid of Giza. We've all grown up recognizing that. And you figure it's been around, officially, it's been around 4,500 years. So you might think archaeologists, scientists, researchers would have figured out who built it, how they built it, why they built it, and most importantly, how old it is. But it turns out the evidence for its age, despite centuries of study, is pretty shaky. And it's not just wrong. The new book that we're going to talk about for the next 2 hours, The Great Pyramid Hoax by Scott Creighton, suggests the evidence is wrong on purpose, that it was the result of a specific hoax, a forgery, dishonesty. And I'll tell you, this book is a great read. It's well-documented, meticulously written, and we're going to jump right into it in just a moment. My next guest, Scott Creighton, is an engineer whose extensive travels have allowed him to explore many of the world's ancient sacred sites. Hey, where do we sign up for that job? For the past 5 years, Scott has hosted the Alternative Egyptology Forum on AboveTopSecret.com, a website we visit often, where he responds to questions and concerning theories about ancient Egypt. And he's here to talk about a great book that has just been released, The Great Pyramid Hoax, The Conspiracy to Conceal the True History of Ancient Egypt. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Hi. Thanks for having me on Coast to Coast. It's a real pleasure to be here.
You know, if I hadn't read your bio that says you're an engineer, I would have had to guess that after reading the book, because, I mean, it is thorough and precise. There's a precision in the way in which you destroy the existing assumptions about the Great Pyramid. It's really a great piece of work.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of research that has gone into that book, George. You know, there's evidence you know, from all different sources, you know, from Vice's private journal, which I managed to track down, from that to high-resolution photographs of the actual marks themselves, you know, a clear analysis of the brush strokes of these marks.
I'll tell you what, we'll get into the specifics.
Yeah.
Set the scene for me first, though. I grew up figuring, you know, I've watched all the shows on the Discovery Channel, I've read books, I've seen documentaries, you know, every school kid thinks that the answers are pretty much settled about the Great Pyramid and other pyramids, who built them and approximately when and how they were built. Give me a lay of the land, sort of, on whether or not there is established science and general opinion on this, or whether it's kind of all up in the air.
Okay. Well, I think the first thing to say about that, George, is that, you know, the key piece of evidence that Egyptologists use to basically insist that the Great Pyramid of Giza, and I suppose all the other Giza pyramids, was built as a tomb of the pharaoh Khufu around 4,500 years ago, that primarily hinges on a number of painted marks, or what we call builder's graffiti, that were found in a series of four previously hidden chambers. And these chambers are situated above the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, and are all roughly the same size. Now, through the writings of the ancient Greek historian Herodotus, you know, he was writing about 2,000 years after the Great Pyramid was supposedly built. It's always been suspected that the builder of the Great Pyramid was known by the Greek name of Sufis or Cheops, which linguists subsequently managed to transliterate into the Egyptian name Khufu, and that the pyramid was built as the king's eternal resting place, his tomb, his instrument of rebirth. Now, the discovery of these painted marks in these chambers by the British explorer and antiquarian Colonel William Richard Howard Vyse in 1837, that moment is regarded by Egyptologists as the holy grail of evidence, as these painted marks do two things, George. The first thing is that it connects the pharaoh Khufu directly to this pyramid. And the view of the Egyptologist, it connects Khufu as its builder. The second thing it does is, through this connection with Khufu, with these painted marks, it was It basically gave the construction date of 2550 BC, because that's when Egyptologists believe Khufu lived. So by finding these marks of Khufu in these hidden chambers, they know when Khufu lived, so that basically dated the structure to 4,500 years ago. Now, the importance of these marks underpinning the mainstream pyramid tomb narrative, you know, it simply cannot be overstated, George. For instance, the eminent American Egyptologist, have probably heard of him, Dr. Mark Lehner. In his acclaimed book, The Complete Pyramids, he describes the discovery of these marks as a clincher piece of evidence to support the mainstream view that Khufu had the Great Pyramid built as his tomb in 2500 BC. You know, these crudely painted marks, which include the royal names of Khufu, they represent the only hard evidence, that directly and physically connects this structure to this ancient Egyptian king. And so it's, I suppose, George, it's probably fair to say that much of what we believe today with regards to the pyramid tomb theory is underpinned by this single piece of evidence. You know, that's the importance to Egyptology of these painted marks. And if you remove these painted marks from evidence, then, you know, Egyptology has a significant problem with their tomb theory. That's basically what's at stake here.
So based on the discovery of these marks inside this hidden chamber in the Great Pyramid, archaeologists have generally settled on the age of the pyramid as dating back to 2550 BC, meaning it had to be built by this guy Khufu. You have made the case in the book that this evidence is wrong. And I can only imagine how this throws everything into up in the air. But tell me this, before we get into specifics, and I want to go back over some of the material you just mentioned, describe for me sort of the setup in when it comes to Egyptian icons like that, that there are keepers of the secrets, there are custodians of these facilities that sort of jealously guard access to it, right?
Are you talking about today, George?
Yeah.
There's antiquities guards all over the Giza Plateau, ensuring who goes in and you know, gets access to these particular chambers. Yeah.
So if you wanted to go in there and take a look at this stuff to verify your theory or to to argue against the prevailing view, you wouldn't be allowed.
Not anymore, no, probably not. I wouldn't imagine so, not after this book. I think it's probably fair to say that, this book will upset the apple cart, so to speak, and probably upset a lot of, mainstream Egyptologists. But, you know, I presented my case. That's what I've done here, George. I've discovered and pulled together all this evidence into this book, and I've said, right, guys, there it is. You come back with me, you come back to me with better evidence than what I presented to prove my case. Where's the evidence to prove that these marks are authentic? You're right. For me nowadays, if I were to go, I've been to Giza, I've went all over the Giza Plateau. I never managed to get into these specific chambers. But, the evidence, was out with these chambers anyway, that these marks were faked. So I didn't have to actually gain specific access to the chambers. I've got the evidence from other sources. Just to answer your question, probably.
Is the word out about this book among Egyptologists? They already know what's coming. I would imagine they know generally what's coming.
Well, they should know, because I wrote to Dr. Zahi Hawass, I think probably a couple of occasions, to ask him to comment on the content of the book, but he declined to do so.
Okay, let's start this way. So the premise, I guess, was first mentioned by a name that should be known to our Coast listeners, Zachariah Sitchin. I had the great pleasure to meet him one time, had dinner with him here in Las Vegas. interesting guy. He explores all kinds of, or it did while he was still alive, he explored all kinds of exotic things, but he focused, and he was the first to suggest that the evidence that established the age of this great pyramid was forged. But he was wrong. He was right, and he was wrong, right?
That's exactly correct, George. I've hit the nail on the head there. Sitchin did do much of the early research into this particular topic, and I think it's fair to say that his research into this issue, it was essentially a side topic in his much broader work. My own book is dedicated entirely to this specific question, the question of the painted marks that Colonel Weiss supposedly discovered in 1837. My book presents much, as I said, a lot of new evidence that Sitchin, Zechariah never even saw or never even knew existed. But I think it's probably fair to say that Sitchin's early work into this question, it did raise a number of pertinent points, some of which remain perfectly valid even to this day. For example, he noted that the lowest of these hidden chambers, known as Davison's Chamber, that had been discovered, I think, about 70 years before Weiss discovered any of the other chambers. Davison's chamber presented not a single painted mark. Now, the curious thing here is at least six people have extensively explored this chamber, and not one of them noted any marks in that chamber whatsoever. And that makes Weiss's claimed discovery all the more remarkable, since all the chambers that he opened, they were painted marks everywhere in them.
So explain what the marks are, so our audience understands what they presumably are.
Yeah, okay, well, the pyramids basically, as you probably know, George, are largely anonymous constructions. There are no official hieroglyphic marks inside any of these the first giant pyramids we're talking about here. Some later smaller pyramids do have, hieroglyphic texts in them known as the pyramid texts, but they're the oldest religious writings in the world. But the first giant pyramids, the first ones that the ancient Egyptians built, have no official hieroglyphics or any writing in them whatsoever. What we have in these four chambers, which Colonel Weiss blasted open with gunpowder.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, we call it gunpowder archaeology. What he basically discovered were painted marks. The paint was basically a red ochre paint. It's just iron oxide mixed with water. Sometimes we put organic material such as gum or fish oil or honey into the mix to act as a binding agent. And they would basically, it's a very crude paint, and they would basically paint these signs onto the stones. Now, these signs are known as hieratic script. They're not actually hieroglyphics. It's basically a shorthand version of hieroglyphics. Hieroglyphics tended to be used in monumental architecture, sculpted, chiseled marks into monumental architecture, whereas the hieratic script, although based on the hieroglyphics, is basically the everyday script that they would use with either paint or on blocks or a pen and reed on papyrus. So it's just basically a handwritten form of the hieroglyphics. So that's basically the type of marks that were painted onto the walls and the roof blocks of these four chambers.
And the assumption has been that it might have been the work gangs, the work crews, had left them on there?
Yeah, that's the assumptions of the Egyptologists. So that's a conventional view, George, that these basically at the quarries, as the quarry gangs were cutting these massive stones out of the quarries, once they'd hewn a block out of the quarry, they would basically put their sign or their gang name on each block, basically showing, that's our work, declaring that block as their work. And these gang names would often include the king's name as part of the gang name. So you would have a whole series of signs painted with red ochre on these blocks, saying something like companions or friends of Khufu or the white crown of Khufu is powerful, that kind of thing. These are the marks that these quarry gangs supposedly painted onto the blocks as they cut them out of the quarry. And once they were delivered to the pyramid, they would then be placed in, you know, onto a particular wall within these chambers. And that is how Egyptologists explain that some of the signs in these chambers, these painted signs, are upside down or rotated 90 degrees or 270 degrees. Sometimes the occasional one are upright, but it's a complete jumbled array of these painted marks in these chambers. And that's because Egyptologists say, well, they weren't too concerned. These marks would never be seen, so they weren't too concerned about having them the right way up. They were more concerned about fitting the blocks into the wall in the best and most efficient manner. So that's how that's the orthodox explanation of these painted marks, that they are, you know, builders' quarry marks.
Yeah, so Egyptologists, this colonel, this British colonel in 1837, he uses dynamite to blow a hole in the side of this thing, finds this chamber, which seems to be an incredibly poor choice of ways to get into the chamber, but that's what he does, and he supposedly finds these etchings, these painted signs, and he uses that to make a name for himself and to establish a baseline that has been used ever since for the age of this great pyramid. Let's start, maybe we'll talk about the colonel himself, because his credibility becomes a key part of this. What did you learn about the colonel when you started digging into his background?
Okay, well, Colonel Vyse, he was born into a wealthy military family, George, a family that had close ties to the British aristocracy, including the Dukes of Cumberland and the Duke of Norfolk. Incidentally, he gained the name Howard from his maternal grandmother, whose ancestry was distantly connected to Catherine Howard, and she was the fifth wife of Henry VIII of England. And sad to say, the poor lady had her head chopped off, unfortunately. Vyse was very much a member of the landed gentry, the ruling elite of his day, and it seems that he was something of a pious man of very little humour, a military martinet who were told fully believed in the literal truth of the Bible, I suppose, as did a lot of people at that time. Now, the Vyse family were also big into politics, George. Colonel Vyse and his father both became members of the UK Parliament. In fact, it's probably Vyse's political career that perhaps shines the brightest light of all into the character of the man, because from his political career, we now know that he was a man of ruthless intent, a man who bribed and lied his way into the UK Parliament in 1807. We've got the documentary evidence for that. It's presented in the book. When Vyse, it just basically seems to me that when Vyse wanted something, nothing at all, it seems, would be allowed to stand in his way of getting it.
I'll tell you what, Scott, we're going to go to a break now. When we come back, sure. I want to pick up the story with Colonel Vyse, because you found written evidence. You got access to notes of his personal journals and logs, and where he basically lays out the case of how he's going to pull off this hoax that has stood the test of time right up until present time. We're talking with Scott Creighton about his book, The Great Pyramid Hoax. Good stuff here to come. Stick around. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. That's from a great album, Venus and Mars, Paul McCartney and Wings. Spirits of Ancient Egypt is the name of the song, and it's certainly no mystery why it applies here. We're talking with Scott Creighton about his new book, The Great Pyramid Hoax. So far, we've learned that the evidence for the age of this pyramid is based on a discovery made by this British colonel in 1837. He blasts his way into a hidden chamber inside the Great Pyramid and supposedly finds these crudely painted marks in the pyramid's hidden chambers that were commissioned by King Khufu, the pharaoh at the time. However, if the evidence is wrong, if it was hoaxed, then it throws everything into disarray. We don't know who built the pyramids. If it's, for example, as many believe, it might be much, much older than the presumed date given to it based on this discovery. So we don't exactly know who built it or why. And when we come back, we're going to find out the evidence that suggests the colonel pulled a fast one on everyone. Right back, more Coast to Coast AM in just a moment. Well, Scott Creighton, before we jump in back into the specifics of what you've uncovered, sort of help walk us through this a little bit. If the date is wrong, if that pyramid is much older than what we've been led to believe, explain what that means. What kind of possibilities it opens up?
Okay, well, my own personal view, George, is that these pyramids most certainly are much, much older structures. I believe they go far back into antiquity to a time and place that we really just don't know too much about at all. What I'm basically saying is that the discovery of these, or the alleged discovery of these marks by Colonel Vice, that claim has basically taken us for the best part of the last 200 years down a blind alley. It's basically taken Egyptology into a straitjacket of the tomb theory. You know, you take these marks away and the whole question becomes an open question again. You know, it's like, we have to go back to back 200 years and reconvene the debate from that time, and use other methods. These pyramids were basically, or the Great Pyramid basically, declared as Khufu's tomb, based solely on the marks of a guy that committed fraud in other aspects of his life. You know, that was the degree, or that was such was the level of science, at that time. You know, they accepted these marks were authentic just basically on this guy's word, on his good character. You know, he's a British colonel, and it was just nonsense. So if we can just, brush all that aside, take that evidence out of the equation and look at these monuments again with fresh eyes, with modern science applied to the question, and get back to basics and find out what the heck these really were all about, because we really, really just don't know. I mean, there are other narratives, that have come down to us, which tell us what the ancient or why the ancient Egyptians built these things, but the Egyptologists simply reject that alternative narrative out of hand, which I personally think is wrong. I don't know if we get time to go into that later, George, but personally, I believe there's a whole entirely different purpose for these structures, and they were built far in antiquity to a time where it's so far ago, we just don't know who it was that did it, or really why did it.
Well, in the case of this pyramid, the assumption is that it too is a tomb. There are no human remains in that pyramid, right?
That's absolutely correct. The Egyptologists refer to the granite box that was found in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid, and they declare, oh, there's a granite box, it must be a tomb. Nonsense! Absolute bunk! You know, George, these stone boxes are totally anonymous. Yeah, there's no inscriptions on the stone box in the Great Pyramid or the stone box they found in the second big pyramid at Giza. Both those stone boxes, the granite boxes, are completely anonymous. Not a single carving engraving on either of them. Now, consider Khufu's sons and daughters, and his Khufu's siblings. You can actually go and you can see their sarcophagi. They were all inscribed and highly decorated with their names and their titles. So there we have contemporary comparisons. you know, we have the so-called sarcophagi of Khufu and Khafre with their siblings, have sarcophagi totally, you know, covered with their titles and names. Khufu and Khafre don't. That just doesn't make sense. But it does make sense if you consider that the ancient Egyptians had more than one name for a stone box. The word sarcophagi or sarcophagus is basically a Greek word, and Egyptologists use that word to classify all these stone boxes, but what they fail to realize is that these stone boxes had different names because they had different functions. The stone boxes in the Great Pyramid and Khafre's Pyramid at Giza, you know, had a completely different function to the known sarcophagi that we do know actually were sarcophagi. These stone boxes and these two big pyramids were called Nebank, whereas the actual sarcophagi of Khufu's sons and daughters and siblings, they're called Kwarsaw in ancient Egyptian. So we've got these different words for different stone boxes, but Egyptologists just classify them all as one thing, and they weren't. They had different functions. So this stone box in the Great Pyramid, it's simply, that's the only piece of evidence they have to say that this was a tomb. But they fail to tell you that the ancient builders had other functions for stone boxes.
Like what?
Well, this goes back. If you look at the later Egyptian dynasties, what you find, George, is that the ancient Egyptians made these small boxes. And what they did with these small ceremonial boxes, they're about 18 inches long by a few inches deep. And basically, these were also called Nebank. And what they would do is they would fill it with earth. And they put a sprinkling of seed on top, and they would put the lid on top, they'd place this in a hole in the ground, and then they would put a large rock on top of it, symbolizing the pyramid. So there you have a ceremonial box in the ground filled with earth with a large rock on top, symbolizing the pyramid. Now, George, in the second pyramid at Giza, in 1818, Giovanni Belzoni became the first modern person to enter the main chamber. I don't call it the burial chamber, I call it the main chamber of that pyramid. He prized the lid off the granite box, the totally anonymous granite box. He prized the lid off it, and guess what he found inside the box, George?
Dirt.
A box full of earth, just like the ancient Egyptians were doing. Years later, dynasties later, they were doing the very same thing. This was part, and just like the small ceremonial boxes, they were completely anonymous as well as these granite boxes. They were the archetype for the later, smaller ceremonial ones. It was part of a completely different culture. This, to my mind, was part of some Chthonic religion, and, you know, Egyptology just completely, you know, it fails to connect the dots between the Nebank, the ceremonial types, and the actual, you know, archetype Nebank that was found in G2. You know, so my own view is that there is a deep Chthonic aspect of, you know, whoever these builders were, this was a deep Chthonic aspect of what these pyramids were. Personally, if you look at the, I can feel myself, George, going off in tangents here.
That's all right.
trying to stay focused on the main question. But my view, these pyramids weren't tombs. They were a recovery system. And Egyptologists will tell you that the pyramids were about rebirth. I say the same thing. Yeah, they were about rebirth. But what the Egyptologists will say is they're about the rebirth of the king. I'll say, no, they're about the rebirth of the kingdom. Because the ancient Egyptians believed that their kingdom was going to be devastated, destroyed by a great flood. Now, this is documented. This is one of the narratives, this alternative narrative that has come down to us via some Arabic scholars. who preserved these ancient Egyptian texts. Now, this particular narrative tells us, as I said, that the pyramids were basically built as some kind of rebirth system. Basically, they would place within these pyramids everything that the kingdom would need in order to be reborn again after this flood that they were anticipating destroyed the kingdom. So that's the narrative that we are told about, but it's one that Egyptologists simply ignore. But there's actually an awful lot of evidence to support the veracity of that particular narrative.
So let me ask you this. If it's not 4,500 years old, how old is it? What's your guess? What kind of time frame?
Well, I've looked at the layout of the Giza structures, George. You've probably heard of the work of Robert Bavall.
Sure.
Who basically says that the main pyramids at Giza are aligned to Orion's Belt around about 10,500 BC. Robert and I have discussed this at length. Robert was definitely on the right track. He missed a couple of important things here, and that was to do with the smaller satellite pyramids at Giza, the two sets of what Egyptologists call the Queen's Pyramids at Giza. Those particular pyramids basically represent what are known as the two culmination points of Orion's Belt. So we're talking about a civilization, George, that could calculate the precessional motion of Orion Belt stars far into the past and far into the future. And what we find is that the Sphinx crosses over this. It's basically a timeline, George, between these two culminations. And basically, the Sphinx crosses over this timeline at the year 20,000 years ago. Giza, we're basically talking about an astronomical clock utilizing the motion of the Orion Belt stars in order to lock down a specific date.
And that 20,000 years ago, who is that? Who are those people? What civilization is that? We don't know.
Well, it's probably the civilization that Graham Hancock calls a lost civilization. We simply don't know who these people were, George. It's simply impossible for me to try and hazard a guess. The ancient Egyptians themselves, they tell us that in the building texts at Edfu, the temple of Horus at Edfu, they tell us in those texts that their civilization goes back 40,000 years. But again, Egyptologists, they will simply brush that aside and no, that's just nonsense. That could never be because they're so wedded to the prevailing narrative that, mankind didn't achieve civilization until just about, 6,000-7,000 years ago, which we now know is actually nonsense because we've recently discovered Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, and there's a temples there which, they've dated to 12,500 years ago. So it seems to me, George, that the deeper we dig, the further back, the history of humanity seems to go. So I have no idea who did this. Nobody does. But this is what I'm saying. This is what I'm saying. We need to forget vices and markings, because that's taken us down the wrong avenue for the best part of 200 years. Put that aside, get proper science, get fresh minds to look at this issue, because while these structures may well have been used as tombs at some point throughout their long, long history, that was categorically not the original reason, in my opinion, why those structures were built, George. Absolutely.
Well, again, not. I mean, the impact of what you're saying here is hard to overstate, because we're talking about the whole history of human civilization. The perceived history of human civilization is sort of resting on this very flimsy evidence that was presented by this British colonel in 1837. which is what your book focuses on. And if you're right and the Egyptologists are wrong, it changes everything.
It does. There's no simple way to put this, George. It changes everything. You know, we need to go back with this evidence. We need to go back to square one, you know, and just look at this whole issue afresh.
I would think that there would be scientific tools that you could use, go into that, get those paint samples and get an accurate date on when that paint was put on the walls.
Well, that's kind of already been done in a way, George. You're probably familiar with the two German university graduates, Dominic Gorlitz and Stefan Erdmann. I think it was in April 2013 they entered the topmost of these hidden chambers, Campbell's chamber, and they removed a small sample of this paint, not from the cartouche itself. The press went daft with this story. They really did. They went really crazy with this story. Oh, they vandalized the cartouche. No, they took a small sample of paint from a fairly insignificant sign elsewhere in the chamber, and they took it back to Germany and had it analyzed. One of the things they were hoping to do was to date the paint, because as I explained at the top of the show, what they would do is put some organic material into the mix when they were creating this paint, like fish oil or honey or whatever, as a binding agent, and they were hoping that they would be able to date that organic material, radiocarbon date that organic material. But it didn't happen, because what Dominic Gorlitz, Dr. Gorlitz, explained to me is that they didn't have enough of the sample. Wow. There wasn't enough of a sample for them to be able to extract sufficient organic.
Well, that sort of goes back to what I meant when I was talking about the keepers of the secrets, the folks who control access. They are jealous guardians of anything that would be perceived as damaging to the structure itself. But I mean, I would think also they don't want somebody to do the testing that would show that they're wrong.
Well, yeah, this is what I call Egyptologists or mainstream historians are basically these marks have become a convenient untruth.
Yeah,
a convenient untruth.
We're talking with Scott Creighton about his new book, The Great Pyramid Hoax. When we come back, I want to get into the diaries. This British colonel who discovered this chamber and supposedly discovered these marks left behind a trail of clues, a trail of breadcrumbs, in a sense. And a lot of people who were interested in these topics wanted to get access to them. And Scott Creighton has gained access to them, and they spill a lot of beans. We'll be right back with more after this on Coast to Coast AM. Straight Cats. The Supremes take us into the break. We'll be right back.